I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
And I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
We're the hosts of Switched on Pop, a podcast about the making and meaning of popular music.
Every week, Charlie and I break down the most interesting hits, trends, and artists to understand what they're doing, what they're saying, and why these songs are so infectious.
We've recently broken down Billie Eilish's music with her brother and collaborator Phineas, dissected Chance the Rapper with super producer Oak Felder, and covered everything from Dolly Parton to Travis Scott.
If you love music, you're going to discover something ear-opening in Switched on Pop.
So join us. Search for Switched on Pop in your favorite podcast app and listen to an episode about your favorite artist.
And subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to get new music explainers every week.
And after listening, you might want to check out our new book, Switched on Pop, How Popular Music Works and Why It Matters at your favorite bookseller. Thanks. Batter up.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to A Pod of Their Own. This is episode 36 of A Pod of Their Own. I am Allison McCaig, and I am joined this week once again by my lovely co-host, Linda Sarovich. Hi, Linda.
Hey, Allison.
And Maggie Wiggin. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Allison.
Maggie is back, everybody.
I missed you all.
Yeah.
Yes, welcome back.
And we will be joined in the second half of the show by our very special guest, so don't go away. But in the first half of the show, we're going to talk about the Mets, and that's not a very cheerful subject to talk about at this time, because obviously, unless you have been, you know, completely living under a rock or on the continent of Antarctica or something.
And we welcome you to go back under the rock, if that's the case.
Yeah,
it seems
it's much
really
better
nice.
There.
Crawl back right back under. It's nice and warm under there. There's no Twitter. It's just like a good place to be.
Yeah, just hibernate until spring, really.
That's what I wish I could do every winter. But yeah, so the Mets, like, this is like, I know that we said the Cespedes wild boar thing is the most quintessentially Mets, but as usual, the Mets like out-Mets themselves. And obviously this time it isn't really their fault, but I do feel it is pretty quintessentially Mets to get caught up in the biggest scandal in like potentially in the sport's entire history, but like not really be doing it on purpose. They've kind of like stumbled into it by accident and are suffering the repercussions of it without actually having done anything.
Or having benefited from it either. Right? Right. Usually when you cheat, you get like wins or other benefits out of cheating. That's why you cheat. But the Mets have somehow paid the price for cheating without ever having had someone cheat for them. And that is, I mean, ethically, I suppose, moderately preferable, but like, still, it's a man. It is Metsy on a whole new level.
Can we just go through the day? Because of course, it happened on a day that they were supposed. It was supposed to be a nice day because they were honoring Mike Piazza, but of course, they had to mess that up too.
Yeah.
Like it all started with Jessica Mendoza, which was its own thing.
Yep.
So it started with her blasting Mike Fiers for coming forward on three different shows. It wasn't just one show. It was three different shows. So I don't know if like that. So clearly that was her talking point. Then that spiraled out of control because clearly everybody disagreed with her. Then they honored Mike Piazza, poor Mike, who got caught up in this whole thing. Jeff Wilpon embarrassed himself at the ceremony by just giving an awful answer. And then, like, right after the Piazza ceremony was over, that's when they decided. So they announced, like, they were mutually parting ways with Beltran. But it's like, you could have avoided that if you had just said something days ago saying, we know Carlos, we stand by him, something, instead of making, like, a mockery of a day you're supposed to be honoring one of the greatest Mets in franchise history.
Well, and the Mets are still undefeated in their ability to not get ahead of a news cycle.
Exactly. Like, yes.
It's like this whole thing came out and they just never once considered the possibility that the player that they knew was on that team and buzz was that he was involved. They didn't have any statement whatsoever prepared. Not even like a, we're very disappointed and blah, 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 and we are, you know, consulting internally on how to proceed, blah, blah, blah. Like, they just had nothing. And what's I don't the... understand how you, like, don't have a plan for that situation that you know has been coming for months. It's just...
And their plan was not to ask. Like, that was Brody's plan.
Don't ask, don't just, tell. That's the plan.
Yeah. And he's best friends with AJ Hinch. Like, come on. You knew something was going on, buddy.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is that the Mets are pretending that they were completely, like, blindsided by this. They were like, oh, my God. We had no idea this was coming. Like, I'm...
Non-zero chance they just forgot.
Yeah, like, I don't... I mean, I know, like, maybe this is overly cynical of me, but I don't believe that. I don't believe that for a second that they didn't know. That they didn't even have, like, a single little inkling of it, given Brody's relationship to AJ Hinch, given, like, you'd think that AJ Hinch would have, like, texted Beltran at some point to be like, listen, Major League Baseball, like, this is going to come down, and, like, the media is sniffing around, like, this is going to come out, you should probably, like... tell the Mets what's going on. And so, like, you mean to tell me that none of the, that they knew none of this? I don't
and then they said that they were leaning towards keeping him until he was specifically named. So it's like, so you're not upset he got caught cheating. You're upset that Major League Baseball named him, which I get is not fair to Carlos because he was the only one named. But still, like, I don't know if that's a good enough reason.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, none of this had good enough reasons. The reason that they fired him was because the media kept telling them to do it. Like, that's the reason. We can argue that, like, they had good that there were good reasons to fire him, but that was not the reasons that the Mets had.
Right.
And that is just so utterly predictable.
Because they would have fired him from the beginning if they felt that there was no coming back from this, which is a legitimate concern.
Absolutely.
Like, Porcello was a victim of this. Stroman has been very vocal about it. So if he's already lost the respect of some of his players, then okay, I get it. But you're saying that wouldn't have mattered. It was but the only thing that mattered was that he was named in the report.
It's the bad PR. That's all they care about. They don't actually, like, if you think the Mets care about integrity, oh boy, I'm going to sell you. And people have pointed this out.
It's a buzzword, Allison. A buzzword.
yeah, right. It has been a buzzword. And I mean, plenty of people have pointed this out on Twitter, that it's hypocritical to the nth degree to, like, employ Jose Reyes willingly while saying that you're a franchise of integrity. I get that. But... yeah, I mean, they arrived at it for the wrong reasons, but I don't know. I mean, in my view, it was the ethically correct decision. Do I think the Mets are acting ethically? No. Do I think this is the ethical outcome? Yes.
Yeah, I don't see how there was any going back, because how do you walk into that clubhouse and look at every player in the eye and be like, sup, guys? So, quiet offseason, huh?
Yeah, really.
But, like, how does Jake Marisnik, like, walk into that clubhouse now?
I mean, how do any Astros walk into it? I mean, but this is part of the problem.
Yeah.
That MLB has decided to, like, just not even go there with the players' union. And I don't totally blame them. Like, boy, does that seem like a lot of paperwork. But, like, it's just the end result is that there's this big sort of question mark, and it's almost like they were like, oh, let's throw them like Carlos Beltran. He can take some players heat. And instead of actually like ironing out and being straightforward about who did what when. And so I kind of feel like, I don't know, they just didn't want to be bothered with it. And they sort of, like, kicked the can down the road to the Mets and was like, you decide what to do. And that's kind of craven on MLB's part, but, like,
MLB,
I don't know. I can
just...
only assume it's going to get worse because it's a mess.
But MLB sincerely, you can tell that MLB sincerely just wants this to go away. Like, they want this to be the one, like, they want to just hand down these punishments and say, all right, rest of the teams that are clearly doing this, you better not get caught slash stop, just stop doing it because we don't want to deal with this anymore. So they are making.
It kind of reminded me a little bit of how the NFL handled the bounty hunting scandal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I was a big Saints fan at the time, and they definitely came on with the same, like, everybody's doing it, but let's be extra tough on these guys, and maybe they'll just all stop.
Yeah, because, I mean, they're the ones that got caught. I mean, like, so, like, do I approve of MLB's handling of this? Like, they hope it's going to be a one-off? No, but, you know, everybody else is doing this is not a justification for any unethical behavior. Like, look at these other people also doing this unethical behavior. So, like, if you get caught, you deserve what's coming to you.
But, like, I don't know if it is going to go away because from what I've seen, the players are angry.
And yeah, I've never seen players worked up this much about any topic.
Yes.
And, like, sort of starting to get there with free agency a couple of years ago. But even then, not quite. This is something that's just, like, really getting a lot of people worked up, which I do have to say, I love the, not love, I mean, it's all terrible, this sucks, but I appreciate the conspiracy theory that the league or owners have been sowing these seeds of discontent to, like, pit the players against each other right before the CBA.
Oh, man.
I don't know if I buy it. It seems like awfully organized for MLB, but I like the theory because, boy, it sure does line up a whole lot of bullshit.
Yeah. If anything, this increases the likelihood of a strike to me.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But like we've said about domestic violence in the past, is being shamed by your peers carries a lot of weight.
Yeah.
So I think that it kind of does need to come from within instead of Rob Manfred sitting on the throne on high saying, here's your punishment, now nobody else talk about it. Like, didn't he tell the Dodgers they couldn't complain or they couldn't talk about it?
Basically.
Yeah.
Well, I think, like, ultimately, what would have stopped this whole thing is if Carlos Beltran or Jose Altuve or whoever had said to their buddies, guys, this is a really bad idea. It's wrong, and we could get in serious trouble, and we're really talented and can win without it. Like, that's what would have stopped this. So, you know, I don't know how you can kind of manufacture that, but yeah, it's, I think internal enforcement's always going to be the best. Cause otherwise you're just sort of, it's just an arms race of technology and technology detecting technology.
Right. And like, ultimately, I mean, speaking of like putting a stop to it, ultimately, obviously, when it comes to, like, who to point the finger at, the buck does stop at the people in charge. It stops at the general manager. It stops at the manager. Mm-hmm. The people, like, AJ Hinch and Jeff Luhnow could have put a stop to this at any time they wanted, whether they're calling it player-generated or not. It doesn't matter whose idea it was. They could have put a stop to it, and they chose not to. Simple as that. That said, I think that there is a lack of nuance in the Beltran discourse that frustrates me, because I basically saw two camps of, like, people, like, Mets people specifically, when it comes to Beltran. It was either you hated him all along, and your hashtag blame Beltran, and you didn't like, you blame him for 06, and you never liked him, and so, you know, screw him, fire him. Or you're in the other camp, which is like, defend Beltran at all costs, and they're making, and he's, you know, he was a scapegoat by the league, and he doesn't deserve this, and he's only named because he's retired. While that is true, it doesn't absolve him of responsibility. It is abundantly clear that Beltran was one of the ringleaders of this scheme. Like, let's not be naive about this. Like, basically, if it wasn't flat out his idea, he perpetuated it to a great extent.
Although MLB doesn't outline any of the specifics in the report, just to be clear, like, this is one of those things where MLB has just decided, like, we have all this information, but we are deciding to not share it. Like, so a lot of this has sort of had to be pasted together from other sources.
Yeah, this is through the grapevine and reading between the lines on things on my part and on others' part. But to me, at least, I can't speak for other people, but to me, it's pretty clear. If especially if you go back, it's like it's public record. I'm not working off of like exclusive rumors I have from like leaked sources by any stretch of the imagination. This is public record. Go back and read contemporaneous articles from when the Astros were in the playoffs and read all about how every single one of those players who are now like being discussed as the primary beneficiaries of this, how they talked about Carlos Beltran. Mm-hmm. Read what Carlos Correa had to say about Carlos Beltran. Read what Alex Bregman had to say about Carlos Beltran. He was the most important person in the clubhouse. He was like a coach. He was the veteran leader. He was like, they talk about Beltran. And that's a, and the reason why this makes me feel icky is because that's why he got the Mets job, is because of his like veteran leadership and like acting like a coach for the Astros. That's code for he did this sign stealing stuff.
Well, they said like, that's what he got hired. Yeah, that's basically what he got hired on, was his credibility and his reputation. And once that was gone, what are you left with?
There are specific quotes from contemporaneous articles about Carlos Correa doing work with Beltran in the video room. What do you think that means? And about
I mean,
how
that could,
it could.
I mean, that's not like, I don't know. That doesn't seem like a stretch to be happening as well. I mean, I don't know, just like video room, like Carlos Correa wasn't out there watching the sign stealing videos, but I don't know. I mean, it, for me, I feel like it really muddies the situation because everyone outside, beyond, you know, well beyond the Astros, has always talked about what an incredible leader Beltran is. And like, you know, there have been people have been saying he'll be a future manager since he was playing for the Mets. Like, it's so yeah. So I don't know. For me, it makes it all the more of a shame that this is coming down, because like I don't think anyone has any doubt that he had or has, I don't know. I mean, he's very young. Baseball has a short memory sometimes, but like I don't think there was ever any doubt that he had the chops to be a really good manager.
Right. Sure.
And like we now know kind of less about that, and we may never actually find out, because who knows when the opportunity will come back for him. Like I said, baseball sometimes has a really short memory and sometimes not so much, so anyone's guess.
Yeah, who the heck knows? I mean, obviously, and like I think it's obvious to anyone who listens to this podcast on the regular, like we feel very differently about this than we feel about Jose Reyes. Like, to me, this does not tarnish my memories of Carlos Beltran, the Met. Like, those are untarnished for me, because as far as we know, those are untouched by the sign stealing stuff. And like, he's not because he did this sign stealing thing, no matter what the extent of his role was in it, doesn't make him a bad human being. The way that abusing your wife does. Like, he by all accounts is still like an A plus grade 80 human being, does amazing charity work, and that this doesn't change any of that. I still will always love Carlos Beltran. He will remain one of my favorite baseball players, whether he's manager of the Mets or not. So
I am here for a long earned redemption arc for him. Like, I want to see some real, you know, growth and dedication towards helping rebuild the integrity of MLB. You know, I don't think it's not just a like show up and be good at a thing and you're fine, the way that some writers like to define redemption arcs for people who did beat their wives. But like, I want him to be in baseball. I want him to earn back that trust in that spot. Because I like him.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm more torn because, you know, Mike Clevenger is Mike Clevenger, but he made the very good point that people's careers could have been destroyed because of this. And there's no coming back from that. Like, yeah. Carlos has a ring. You know, what did he lose? A match job that he had for 77 days? His reputation, okay, but it was still 100% worth it. They got their ring.
Yeah.
Like, So we'll never know the full extent of to the people, like how far this reached and who it affected and their livelihoods. So I don't think that it's that cut and dry that you can just say we can move on from this, because some people never can because their career was destroyed. Like Chris Flexen pitched in and Matt Harvey got blasted his first start coming back off the DL by the Astros. Was his confidence shot by that? He was probably already on pretty shaky ground at that point.
Yeah, for
also
sure.
The nerve damage in his arm.
Well, yes, that probably played
he part couldn't of it. Feel his fingertips.
Yeah. I mean, that probably had part of it, but like, you know, how do we know if, you know, he didn't have an answer for why the Astros are killing me right now? And then maybe that spiraled from there with his confidence. I don't know. I can't speak for him. I'm not in his head. But, you know.
Yeah, we will never be able to actually measure in any. Like, we may learn more in the future. Like we said, I don't think this is going away. Like MLB hopes it will. We may learn more about the pervasiveness of this, which has already been hinted at that it is pretty pervasive. But we will never be able to measure its impact. It's just intangible, the impact that this has had, and it's bad. I mean, like, this is, to me, I again, not speaking for anybody else personally, this is worse than the steroid era, because the steroid era had a kind of vibe of like players mostly acting on their own, and like some of them were trying to recover from injury. And, like, it had the same, like, arms race mentality of, like, oh, everyone else is doing steroids, so now I have to, which is the same with the sign-stealing stuff, just technology. But, like, to me, the, like, involvement from the top down is what makes this extra gross. It's almost like as if the GM was, like, handing out steroids to all the players. Like, the steroid era would have to be that bad to match this. I don't know.
I worry, like, the comparison I feel like is a tough one for me, because just from the health perspective, you know, because that is my background, like, we're talking about players being incentivized to harm their bodies, and that I have a lot of trouble kind of being okay with in a larger sense. And I think a lot kind of does depend on how pervasive this really is. But it's also something that MLB could make go away with allowing pitchers and catchers to use communication devices. But that's a whole other story.
But then those would get hacked and, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's, I don't know. It's not like it's not a big deal. I just have trouble putting it in the same category. And I say that as someone who, like, regularly will advocate for steroid users being allowed into the Hall of Fame, for example. I don't know. It's a tough one to wrap my head around, but, like, you know, is Jose Altuve not going to make it into the Hall of Fame because of this if he keeps up good numbers?
Yeah, it's a good question.
Interesting to see.
Yeah, I don't
know. Time will tell.
We've talked a lot about, I mean, like, baseball has talked a lot about how this may affect Carlos Beltran's Hall of Fame chances, because obviously he's closer to, you know, that we're closer to that conversation with him because he's retired and will be up for the Hall of Fame shortly, but these other players are obviously further away from that because none of them are retired yet, and most of them have not yet amassed the career that Carlos Beltran has, so it may end up being a moot point because they may not get the numbers with or without cheating, so it would be a moot point. But for some of them, it may not be. Like, you know, these are really good baseball players. Alex Bregman, Carlos Correa, Jose Altuve, like, if they keep going on the trajectory they're going on paper, they could be Hall of Famers someday. And we won't know if people will take this into account the way they have taken steroids into account. with their Hall of Fame votes.
I definitely don't think Beltran will be getting his number retired.
By the Mets? Hell no.
He embarrassed the organization. I think there's no coming back from that.
Nope, that's done.
Yeah, which sucks. I mean, this does suck. Like, I'm sad. I'm really sad about it. Make no mistake. Like, even though...
No winners.
Even though I, like, think it's the ethically correct decision to fire him, I'm still, like, super freaking bummed out about it.
Yeah, like, it's sad. It's sad that he torpedoed his career, his reputation, everything because of this.
Yeah.
And, but, I don't know. I don't know if none of them have apologized. None of them have admitted it. They come off looking awful in every interview they give.
Yeah, right.
So, I don't know. I don't know if anything's going to change or if they regret what they did, because none of them have said anything. So we'll never know.
Yeah. Speaking of looking awful in interviews, I do want to touch very briefly before we close out this segment on Jessica Mendoza, who Linda mentioned very briefly during that timeline where she talked about how in one day this all happened. The day started off with Jessica Mendoza on many different shows. Like you said, it's multiple shows. And that's the thing. Is like, and they issued a statement later being like, oh, let me clarify, I didn't quite mean it that way. It's like, you said the same thing on three shows. Clearly you meant it. Like, what the hell are you doing?
So, and then Brody was like, no, she was speaking as an analyst and not as a med at that point. That's not how it works. That's not how any of this works.
Like, so basically, for those of you who didn't see this, Jessica Mendoza, currently employed by the Mets front office, on like three different shows, basically said about Mike Fiers, snitches get stitches. Like, in so many words, she said she wasn't happy about like Mike Fiers going to the media and how he should have, you know, whistleblowers should like go to their own teams or go to baseball. It's like, do you really trust, like, the teams are doing it? The teams are orchestrating it. How can you trust, like, Major League Baseball and teams to handle this properly? Come on.
And other players have chimed in with the same deeply troubling opinion, too, which is also that it isn't just her.
Right.
But it's definitely a thing.
I've been seeing more anger on the part of current players. It's former players who are saying snitches get snitches, like Pedro Martinez just came out with that.
Yeah,
what you want.
The generational divide is like very obvious here. And, you know, with Jessica Mendoza, it's not only that this is a highly problematic opinion, it's that her conflict of interest here is obvious. Like, I don't know, like, when Jessica
Did the Mets send her out to say that in a last gasp attempt to like save Beltran? Like, no, really, Beltran wasn't the villain here. Like, we don't know.
They had to have the decision made by then, but that just—I mean—that just points to their inability to get a message out. And it is. You shouldn't have a team consultant talking in the media about any major decision like this. I mean,
especially one that would direct your team directly.
Yeah.
Like she's out here as a broadcaster. That's bullshit. She's out here being angry because like the manager just got fired for the team she works for over it. Like, come on. When she
it's
was
almost
first
like
hired,
this messy setup is turning out to be messy. Who would have guessed?
Yeah. And when she was first hired, I was a huge like proponent and defender of hers. Like when other people were talking about the problematic conflict of interest stuff, don't get me wrong, I didn't think it was like not there or like not a problem, but like I thought people were overplaying the problem because she was a woman, because A-Rod and all these other people who have had this similar conflict of interest, they did not bring the same energy for those guys, only for her, and that remains true. And I thought the whole thing was overplayed. This is the first time where I've kind of been like, this is so obviously a problem right now. Like,
she did herself no favors. Like, the rumors were already there, or like the whispers were already there. Like, I think the Dodgers wouldn't let her in the clubhouse or something last year. But yeah, this, she just absolutely did not do herself any favors with that.
Yeah.
And then also there's no limit, because one day or like 2 days after an article comes out about the 1990s Mets like raping a woman, they decide, oh, we want David Cohn to replace Jessica Mendoza.
Yeah, Jesus
yeah,
Christ.
Yeah, that's we got a lot to talk about next week.
That's a whole separate pod, guys, about that. Because of this whole sign stealing stuff, that article basically went untalked about. And it's a huge bombshell of an article.
I think we should just pretend next week that it was published for the first time.
Yes. Okay.
We should all just like agree to
go back in time.
We will, in future pods, discuss that because it's its own whole own show for that article. But in the meantime, before we switch topics, I just want to mention really quickly for our listeners that in a future pod on February 25th, mark your calendars, so you have about a month, we will be discussing Baseball Maverick, Sandy Alderson's book. We have hinted on previous pods that we'd like to do a book podcast in the off season, sort of like in a pod of their own book club, so to speak. So we've chosen our first book. It's Baseball Maverick. We figured that was a nice book that a lot of Mets fans have already read. And if you haven't, it's probably essential for, you know, Mets fandom to have that in their arsenal. So we will be discussing the book. We will be having our literary correspondent, Kellyanne Healy, on to discuss the book with us. So we hope you'll join us for that February 25th. So between now and February 25th, if you haven't read it already and you want to follow along, read Baseball Maverick. It's really worth it. But in the meantime, we are going to take a short break. And when we get back, we are going to have Cheryl Ring on as a guest. And we are very excited to talk to her about what got her into baseball, chat about the cheating scandal and domestic violence more widely in baseball, and more. So stay tuned for that.
I'm Jillian Weinberger, host of The Impact, a podcast from Vox about how powerful people affect the rest of us. This season, we're looking at the big ideas from all the people running for president in 2020.
Hit this opioid crisis head on.
Public option.
Move away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency.
And it's going to be a great wall, and it's going to work.
A lot of those ideas have actually been tried before, like that wall Trump wants to build. Nogales, Arizona has had one on its border for decades.
I don't understand why individual people have a right to have a fence, and yet a country can't.
Senator Warren's proposal to end the opioid crisis? It's based on what we did to fight the AIDS epidemic.
We would like to name it the Ryan White Care Act.
And the Green New Deal. Germany tried something similar in 2000.
This is the solution.
This season on The Impact, we have those stories. How the big ideas from 2020 candidates worked or didn't work in other places or at other times. These are the stories that will help us understand what might happen if these proposals get rolled out here in the next 4 years. Subscribe to The Impact on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app to get new episodes now.
And welcome back. For this segment of the show, we have a very special guest on with us. We have Cheryl Ring, formerly of Fangraphs and currently of Beyond the Box Score. And you just got an editing gig there, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
I did. I am very lucky. Beyond the Box Score is an awesome place to write, and this is an awesome place to talk baseball. So thank you for having me.
Of course. We're very excited that you are here. We would like to get our listeners who aren't familiar with you and your work up to speed a little bit. So tell us a little bit about what kind of brought you to baseball writing, because for those of you who don't know, Cheryl has a legal background, which brings like a really unique perspective to her writing, which is really awesome. So kind of what brought you to baseball writing, and what are some of your favorite things you've ever written?
So that's actually a really hard question. Because yes, as you said, I'm a lawyer. I'm a legal aid lawyer. So I represent people who can't afford lawyers, kind of like a public defender for civil cases. But baseball has always been my first love. And it goes back a very long way. I wrote about my childhood for Fangraphs last year about how when I was growing up, I did not have the most affirming parents, especially once I came out to them as trans when I was around 8 years old. And one of the things that my mother tried taking away from me was baseball, because I was that girl who just liked to throw up a ball in the backyard and hit it and then go and get it and do it again. And so for me, the lifeline I had, because my mother pulled me out of school, she tried putting me through conversion therapy, things like that, to sort of detrans me, which, spoiler, doesn't work. But my lifeline during that time was baseball. My father used to come into my room at night when my mother was already sleeping at 2 or 3 a.m., and he would tell me about the Yankee game. He would tell me what the score was. He would leave me newspaper box scores under my pillow, and he would always say, "Don't tell your mother." And so it became my connection to the outside world, my reminder that I really was normal, that I was not the abomination that she said I was. And so for me, baseball has always been this, it's been very much a metaphor for life. It's this idea that the game is never over. Like my father had a saying, you play in the inning you're in. And for me, that took on a significance far more than just the game. And it's not an exaggeration to say that those box scores that he left for me when I was a teenager, they very much did save my life. And so one of the things that I have tried to do in baseball writing is connect the things that I see as important about baseball for so many kids out there who, like me, baseball is more than just a game, where baseball means more, or it should mean more than just something we watch for entertainment. Because yes, at the end of the day, that's what it is. But it's also about connecting people with each other. It's about stories. It's about human interaction. And so that's supposed to be the best of us. And that's why it was so important for me when I was growing up, because it was my connection to humanity through baseball, through the stories that those box scores told about beating adversity. And I will never forget the reading the box scores during the 1998 season, that year the Yankees won 114 games during the regular season. And that was a year where that was the only thing that seemed to go right for me. That was the year I turned 10. And in a world where there was so little room for me just to exist, where it was so impossible for me just to exist as the girl that I was with my own family, that was something that gave me reason to get up in the morning to read that box score. And that's something that is, for me, it is a very special thing, and I know it's not unique to me. I know all of us, no matter what's going on in our lives, look to baseball for that same kind of thing, and too often it lets us down. So one of the things I've tried to do with my writing is to try and shine a spotlight on things that matter about baseball, because if we're going to be having this connection with each other, it should be reflective of the best of us in every way. And so you asked me what things I've written that I liked the most. There's a couple of things that I'm proud of. One, I wrote in the 2019 Baseball Prospectus Annual a piece called "What If the First Woman in Baseball Is Already Playing?" And that was a piece that's very personal for me for very obvious reasons. And it comes down to this. If you look at the numbers, the idea that every single person playing in affiliated baseball right now, and we're talking about literally 2,000 plus people, that every single one of them is cisgender or not trans, that defies the odds. It is possible, but it's not very likely. And so the question is, why do we have a culture in affiliated baseball that isn't welcoming of people who would be comfortable coming out as trans and playing professional baseball? How much does that play into it? What kind of legal protections would there be? Is this something that we should be talking about? And I think we should, because at the end of the day, we talk about, well, what's going to happen when non-men break into baseball. Well, how do we know that there aren't women or non-binary people already playing and we simply haven't given them a place where they can feel comfortable playing baseball and being themselves? That would be a really sad thing, but we honestly can't look at the game as it exists today and say, yes, a non-binary person or a trans woman would feel comfortable in this Major League Baseball environment. Of course they wouldn't. And so that's something where I think we should be deeply concerned, because looking at the numbers, the idea that every single person playing affiliated baseball is a cisgender man is just, it doesn't seem likely. I also wrote a piece late last year proposing an alternative for Major League Baseball's policy on domestic violence. And I have been extremely critical of the league about how it's handled intimate partner violence and domestic violence, basically since I started writing about baseball back at the beginning of 2018. And it always seems to come back to a couple of things. Baseball as a league dehumanizes players in much the same way it dehumanizes survivors of intimate partner violence perpetrated by those players. And the penalties simply contribute to that same dehumanization. If you are having a penalty that turns a player who has committed one of these acts into a distressed asset to be bought at a discount, like with Roberto Osuna, then that's not really punishment. That's simply treating players like fixer-uppers. And once you learn to dehumanize one group of people, you can dehumanize any group of people. It's really a simple matter to transfer that dehumanization from one group of people to another. And so what I try to do is draw upon the research that has been done and come up with a plan that simultaneously acknowledges that people who commit intimate partner violence are also human beings that need to be punished, but that zero tolerance policies have historically not worked. That if you look at the data, zero tolerance policies cause more recidivism, make it harder for survivors to come forward, and create a survivor-centric model where any discipline is focused on the needs of the survivor as opposed to what either zero tolerance, which is what some people have called for, or on the other hand, simply waving it away, or the current system, which almost incentivizes domestic violence so you can get traded to a contender. Or, and this is another problem with the system that we see right now, about 42% of major league players are players of color. But so far, of the 15 players who have received some kind of administrative suspension under the policy, 13 have been players of color. But the numbers tell us that overwhelmingly the people most likely to commit intimate partner violence are white men. So either Major League Baseball self-selects for white men who are less likely to commit intimate partner violence and black and brown men who are more likely, which just doesn't make any sense, isn't borne out by the data, and frankly is racist, or what is more likely, which is the Major League Baseball's policy is simply not catching people who commit intimate partner violence who are white. And so that adds another layer of problems onto this policy that I think we need to take a hard look at in terms of how we deal with this moving forward.
I think that something that you touched on that really spoke to me is talking about how, you know, baseball as an escape. But I think that when we look at baseball and we see it reflect so many of the deep moral failings of our society back at us, as is inevitable since baseball is part of our society, I think that's why I have trouble explaining it to people who aren't as deeply invested in baseball as I am and as many people in our community are. Like, it's hard to describe, because I think the reason why we see baseball as an escape is and why we react so much to its failings is because we care so deeply about it, because it's served this role for us in our lives as a reason to get up in the morning. So that's, like, that really spoke to me. But as far as, you know, as far as domestic violence and the moral failings of baseball are concerned, why do you think there's such a cognitive dissonance on baseball's part between dealing with issues of domestic violence and human trafficking, for example, which is another huge moral failing of Major League Baseball, and, you know, cheating and steroids and this sign stealing scandal? Why do you think there's such a cognitive dissonance of how baseball reacts to one versus the other? Do you think it's just because, like, they think it's too hard to change their domestic violence policy to be more reflective of, like, what works? Or is there another reason?
I think there is another reason. I think that Major League Baseball is, and it kind of goes back to what you were just talking about. What is Major League Baseball? Yes, it's a reflection of our society. But also, at the end of the day, Rob Manfred, as commissioner, he is not representing the fans of baseball. He's representing 30 owners. Mm. And what are those 30 owners? Those 30 owners are the same people who in many ways are at least indirectly responsible for many of the same inequities that we see in everyday life. Steve Cohen is a great example. He is in the process of taking over the Mets. He's also, and I wrote about this for Beyond the Box Score, he's also the proud owner of the largest fine for insider trading ever levied by the SEC. And there's been some really great research done on just how much wealth that was lost as a result of the various insider trading schemes that his company's engaged in over the years. And it's why it was somewhat surprising, but not shocking, to see Major League Baseball so willing to welcome him into its group of owners, because this is very much who the owners are. Major League Baseball doesn't have these problems simply because it reflects society, but also because many of these owners are the same people who contribute to these same inequities in society at the end of the day. If it was profitable for Atlanta's baseball team to stop using the tomahawk chop, it would stop tomorrow. But they don't, because it makes money. And at the end of the day, it's a profit-seeking operation. One of the most important things that anyone has ever said to me about baseball, the amazing Howard Bryant, who I interviewed for my last piece that went up today at Beyond the Box Score, he told me when I was speaking with him, and I put this in the piece, baseball has become essentially a suburban white sport. And we see this with Atlanta, moving from Atlanta now into SunTrust Park, which is basically in the suburbs. And it's a suburban white sport buttressed by foreign labor. And we don't really care where that foreign labor comes from. That's really, if you look at American society, increasingly, that's what American society is being turned into by these same people who are in charge of the economy. We are turning America into a suburban white country buttressed by foreign labor, and we don't really care where we get it from. And the question at the end of the day is this something we're okay with? Is it something where we are okay exploiting people for this economic model? It's very much a reflection, but it's the same people doing both. And that's kind of how I look at it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think the first time that it really hit me about, you know, I always knew that baseball was, you know, primarily a white man's game and becoming more and more so. But I think the first time it hit me was when I moved to Baltimore for graduate school, and I started going to Orioles games more. And I would look at the stadium and I would say, this doesn't look like the city I live in at all. This looks like the suburbs.
But it's very true. But what's really interesting, if you look at Baltimore, and I grew up very near there. If you look at Baltimore, there were newspaper articles for the last decade about how it's dangerous to have what they called urban youth going into the Inner Harbor. And of course, the Inner Harbor is right next to where Camden Yards is. But these are people who live this in Baltimore. This is their city. So to say, we're not going to let, because when they say urban youth, it's code for black kids. To say, we're not going to let black kids go to a ball game or go to the Inner Harbor in their city that they live in because of white tourists,
yeah,
that's a really dangerous sentiment. And at the same time, we don't really see baseball doing anything about it other than as their own version of white flight. And that's really a problem. It really is a problem. And if we're going to start looking at baseball and saying, okay, how can we make baseball more of the game that we want it to be, more of the game that it should be? How do we create a game that we can be proud of? The first thing we have to do is we have to confront some of these extremely uncomfortable truths about the game that we all love and what it represents and what that means. Because in order to know where it is that we have to go, we have to understand where it is that we are now. And sometimes that's a very sobering picture.
But how do you, like, my issue is, like, we bring these issues up, we write the articles up, and how do you make the change? Because it's like, for us, a lot of times, it just seems like we're screaming into the void and nobody's listening. And, like, Manfred clearly has his priorities screwed up. So how do we go about bringing these things to the light or seeing results or changes?
Have Cheryl on your podcast for one.
Yes.
Well, I appreciate it, but I don't think I have a magic wand. I'll tell you what I do think, though. I have always held to the belief, since I started doing work in legal aid, since I was doing consumer rights work, representation matters. Because at the end of the day, people will not respond to what they don't see. Representation matters. And we need to make baseball a sport that is safe for representation. I think that part of the job is just showing up. You know, a bunch of women sitting down and talking about baseball, which shouldn't be controversial, but yet today somehow still is. And having these conversations. And then we go and we say, okay, is it okay for us to be considering as our national pastime a sport that does X, Y, and Z, and make sure that conversation is out there and consult the people whose voices matter. It's one of the reasons why I was so very honored that Howard was willing to talk to me about it, because he is someone who is an expert on this and who has lived this far more than I ever will as a white person. And so I think it's incumbent upon us to go to where the people are who need that representation and give that to them with the platforms that we have. I think that's very important. Number two, I think when somebody else brings up a problem like this, we should be there also to join in. When Ryan Helsley did a very brave thing, I think, during the playoffs, talking about just how not okay it is in the 21st century for major sports franchises to be using a racist chant. There was way too much silence from sports media. And even just his being one courageous person and calling that out, was there enough change from Atlanta? No, but there was something. There was something. And they made more changes in response to what Ryan Helsley said than they had in the previous 20 years. That matters. And that brings me to the last thing, which is we in sports media have to call out sports media. And that's something that I tried to do when I wrote about Jonah Carey earlier this year and late last year. The issue with how sports media has handled Jonah Carey is that here we have someone who is reflective of the problems in the game. If you have a sport made up mostly of white men, covered by white men, you cannot be surprised when things like racism and misogyny and homophobia and transphobia start coming up unchecked, because you don't have the people in the right places to check those privileges. And I think that it's incumbent upon us, when we see something like that, when we see an injustice that's going on and nobody's talking about it, bring that up and call out the fact that nobody's talking about it. Make it get covered. Because if we can force people to look, that's the start. And yes, it's hard. And yes, it can be grueling. And yes, it can turn the game that we love into something that's not something that we love. But I think it's worth it. Because remember, at the end of the day, those same 30 owners who own these baseball teams are, like I said before, these are 30 billionaires out of 600 or so that are in the United States who control the vast majority of wealth in the country. So if we're going to talk about how we're going to change baseball, it is very much the same as how we're going to change the country. It comes down to making sure that when there is an injustice happening, we make sure people look, that they cannot turn a blind eye to it. Because I firmly believe that at the end of the day, you cannot, if a human being is forced to look, if they do not have the option of pretending it isn't there, if they are forced to look, enough of them will say it's not okay. People just don't like being forced to look because it snaps them out of their idea that if it's out of sight, it's out of mind, that this doesn't happen anymore. And that's something I encounter a lot in my day job also. I'm a fair housing lawyer, so I do a lot of housing discrimination cases. And the number one thing I hear from people when I'm talking about this work is that doesn't happen anymore. By the statistics, it happens more now than it did a decade ago. But people think that if they don't see it, it doesn't happen. If it isn't on the news, it doesn't happen. And so what we have to do is we have to make sure that this stuff gets covered. It's why what Ryan Helsley did was so brave. And I think that it's something that we have to do, make sure we talk about this and force people to see it.
And it's always the, he was always so kind to me trope as well.
That yes.
Muddies the waters yes. and makes it so people don't have to see.
Well, and that's something about Jonah that I heard from a lot of men who had worked with him and strikingly few women, which I think speaks also to your point, Cheryl, about representation mattering, because
yes.
in these situations, men and women do see very different things, and Black people and white people will see very different things contextualized in their life experiences and the sense of self-preservation that we have all learned to develop over the years of our lives. And so you need those different voices in the room because they're seeing different things. And it's just, you can't replace that with wokeness or research or anything. It's just about lived experience.
Exactly. And here's another great example. C.C. Sabathia and Adam Jones talked for years about racism they experienced at Fenway Park. And for years they were told, basically, they were imagining it, even after they said it again and again and again. At a stadium where outside for years was a street called Yawkey Way, named after an inveterate racist. So there's a certain degree of lack of awareness that comes along with a lack of representation. And I think so long as we are going to be, if we mean what we're saying, that we have to have this conversation, that we have to make sure that we call on people who have the platforms to bring as many people to the table as possible with those needed perspectives that we simply cannot provide. Because unfortunately, the owners aren't going to do it for themselves. They're going to do it based on what makes them the most money. But if enough people say, this matters to me, then it will matter to them. It's how the logo in Cleveland ended up getting changed, although now there's a campaign back, which is a subject for another time. But that's how the logo in Cleveland ended up getting changed. Enough people said, this matters, but ownership decided, okay, we're going to retire this. Again, it was not enough, but it was something. And what we have to decide is, where are we going to draw a line? What do we consider to be behavior that is not acceptable, that matters enough to us that we will not buy tickets, or that we'll call ownership, or that we'll cancel season tickets, or that we'll watch on TV instead of going to a game? One example that I think is really important is the Ricketts Group in Chicago. Political issues aside, this is a group that tried to pass off ADA compliance, and I wrote about this for Beyond the Box Score, tried to pass off compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act as putting one wheelchair accessible seat in the stadium for every 1,000 seats for able people. And that is just beyond egregious, because the statute required a minimum of 5 times that. So for them to say in court filings with a straight face, we only needed to put in 40 seats, and none of them have unobstructed views. And then for them to go beyond that and say, okay, we're not going to put in any more seats because you complained about this. and then justify it as, well, we're having the Justice Department do a review of it. This is something that should matter to Cubs fans, because if you are a disabled Cubs fan right now, you do not have the luxury of an unobstructed wheelchair accessible seat. This is something that should matter. The problem is, when you are listening to people who cover the Cubs, all you hear about is, are we going to shake the fence? You don't hear about the fact that if you are a Cubs fan and you want to go and see your team and you are in a wheelchair, you can't, because you won't have an unobstructed view. And that's not okay. And that's the kind of thing where we need to say, at the end of the day, this matters enough that we will act in solidarity with people who are being harmed by this, and we will vote with our dollars. And yeah, that's a big ask, but these owners are not going to be worse off for it. And I don't think it's unreasonable to say, if my neighbor can't go and watch a game because of something they have no control over, I won't go and watch that game.
Yeah, we will, since this is a topic of conversation, we will definitely link in our show notes the episode, harken back to the episode we did about this, because we actually did an episode about accessibility of stadiums and how it's not a talked about thing, because Citi Field has its own issues that we discussed during that episode, especially accessibility of the subway station that's right outside Citi Field. It's extremely not accessible.
So. Because it's very, I mean... It's so up the alley of the people we would expect it to be to slap on. And, you know, the Mets do some things right. They have many accessible seats. They have them in almost every single section. But, like, that's the easy part. The hard part is doing the work with the representation of talking to the people affected, taking a step back and looking how it fits into the whole context of their lives. Because, you know, the Mets... It took me 30 seconds of reaching out to fans to find that subway accessibility was a huge problem. It took me no time at all. And the Mets did not ever do that. When I spoke to the Mets after they started their no backpack policy, they were super surprised to find out that people with certain types of physical disabilities can only use backpacks. Like, this was surprising to them. And it's because they're not doing the work to listen to the groups who are affected by it. And it's just another area where this attitude is pervasive.
You're absolutely right. But the question, as always, goes back to who's making the decisions and why are they making them? And it's one of the reasons why for example, the discipline in the Astros case came down the way it did. Rob Manfred is making the decisions. He's making them for the owners, to benefit the owners. He's not making them for any other reason. Because if you look at the MLB Constitution, that's what his job is. He represents the owners. So when we look at baseball in this way, it really explains why things happen the way they do, why the policies are enacted the way they are, why you have service time manipulation, and why the commissioner's office doesn't care, because it benefits the owners, and his job is to benefit the owners. And at the end of the day, that's the only thing that he cares about, and that's his job. And remember also, Rob Manfred is a labor lawyer. That's what he was trained in. That's what he knows. So when he does something that impacts players or impacts minor leaguers or proposes eliminating 42 teams, he knows exactly what he's doing. He's not stupid. He's acting for the benefit of the owners, and these things are features, not bugs.
Yeah, for sure. And so, like, I'm just curious about your thoughts, because I've heard varying predictions on this, but, like, kind of speaking of the cheating scandal punishments, what do you think the likelihood is? And I guess you could slap a percentage likelihood for each person, but what do you think the percentage likelihood is that AJ Hinch and Jeff Luhnow, Alex Cora, and Carlos Beltran work in baseball again? Because I think that the percentages vary for each of those individuals.
You know, the one thing I'm going to say because I read through Manfred's report fairly closely, the first thing that jumps out at me is that the suspensions for the four of them are lacking language that the suspension for Brandon Taubman includes. Taubman has to apply for reinstatement. The other four don't. Their suspensions, essentially, and pending Cora's, of course, because we don't know what his discipline is going to be, but their suspensions automatically end. So I would be very surprised, especially with Beltran, who's generally held in very high regard, I'd be surprised if he didn't work in baseball again. Because remember, also, he got no real discipline from this at all. And there are legal reasons behind that. And I went through that at some length for Beyond the Box Score also. It's going to be hard to say we're not going to consider him for any position when he wasn't technically disciplined for anything. A.J. Hinch is also generally well-regarded. I think he could land a coaching job. I'd be surprised if he didn't. So I'm going to say for Beltran, it's 95%. I'm going to say for Hinch, it's 80%. I'll say for Lunau, it's going to be a lot lower. I'll put the odds on him at 50-50. And the reason I'm going to be lower on him is twofold. Number one, Manfred went out of his way to pin everything on Lunau. Lunau was his fall guy. He went out of his way to insulate Jim Crane from criticism, which is unsurprising because Crane is who he works for, and to pin everything on Lunau and basically say this is the culture that Lunau created that caused all of this, and it's all his fault. So Lunau, to a certain degree, is now toxic. Yes, Manfred complimented him on his ability in creating a team, but he also credited him for creating the culture that led to the incident with Allison Footer, that led to the cheating scandal for two separate years, that led to the team looking the other way, even when they had knowledge of this. And he put far more blame on Lunau than he did on Hinch. He was very clear about how he was doing this. So to me, I think that Manfred was basically, especially that paragraph where he talks about the way that employees were treated and how that led into the corporate culture, that was unnecessary for that report. And that was Manfred all but coming out and saying, at least that's how I took it, it was him all but coming out and saying, don't hire this guy again, I don't want him in baseball. He wasn't going to give him a permanent ban, because it would have raised too many questions. But I think he was coming out and telling teams not to hire him. So I'd say 50-50 for Lunau, depending on if a team wants to take a chance on him as like to work in the scouting department or something like that. As far as Cora goes, he's going to be the toughest to figure out. And the reason I say that is he's probably going to get the longest suspension, and he doesn't have a job right now. And at the same time, he's somebody who is held in pretty high regard throughout the game. And he comes from a family that is held in regard throughout the game. But he did this for two separate teams. So I'd say Cora probably has the worst odds of the four of them of working in baseball again. And honestly, that's a bit upsetting to me, because I think of all of them, Lunau should have the longest odds, but I definitely think Lunau would get a job before Cora would.
I have a quick, I don't know if I've ever seen anything, but are Hinch and Lunau suspensions happening now, or does it start when they get hired? Okay.
So in theory, they're happening now, as far as I know. However, there has been some question about that. Because they were in theory fired for the purpose of, because they would not have been able to manage or general manage the team. So as far as I know, their suspensions are happening now. There has been some debate about whether or not they would still have to serve them if they were hired by somebody in the future. But to the best of my knowledge, this is the year that they are serving them. So because if somebody hired them tomorrow, they would serve it this year. And the reason I know this is, if you look at the report, it says the suspension expires at the end of the 2020 World Series.
Mm.
And that's the difference. And that's why I pointed out the difference between their language and the language on Taubman. Because Taubman it says he, it specifically says he has to apply for reinstatement. But Luhnow and Hinch, it says that they are reinstated automatically after the 2020 World Series.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Got it. So we talked about this a little bit in the first half, but you know, it's easy to sort of see some parallels emerging with like the steroid era, for example. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how you envision this, I don't know what we would call it, the garbage can era of baseball. How it
I feel like that's apt.
Yeah, it covers so many different issues. But how is this going to fit into the story of baseball? You know, Beltran's going to be up for the Hall of Fame in a couple of years. You know, I think certainly it's harder to say with younger players, but Altuve is slash was easily on track for Hall of Fame kind of numbers. But what part of the story of baseball does this tell? Or do we not even know yet? Because Lord knows there's a lot more out there.
I think honestly it depends on if we find out that the Astros really were wearing buzzers. And I know that that sounds weird and it's a bit of a cop-out, but let me explain what I mean by that. The rules that were violated didn't technically go into effect until the 2016-2017 offseason. And even Manfred's own report points out that the memoranda that were sent around to all the teams were sent around in 2017 and 2018. So there's a question as to what was against the rules before those memoranda. And I wrote for Fangraphs a couple of years ago about how there were questions about people in the stands with cameras, and then there were the Red Sox with the Apple Watch incident. And those were pretty light punishments because there weren't any express rules. And it wasn't until after that that Manfred started cracking down on this. But it does seem that for a while, this was something where teams were doing it. The question is, how many teams were doing it? Because we truly don't know. And so I think this is, in that sense, different from what we call the steroid era, and probably also worse. Because when we were in the steroid era, there's that famous interview of Mark McGwire with Bob Costas where he has a bottle of Andro in his locker in plain view. This was an accepted part of the game. Everybody did it and made really no attempt to hide it. This was never that. This was always done with attempts to hide it. This was never in the open. And so there's this sort of consciousness of guilt aspect that even before it was against the rules, clearly the fact that it was being done surreptitiously suggests, well, we are not necessarily like telegraphing to the world, oh yeah, we steal everyone else's sign. And it seems that some teams genuinely weren't involved in it, like Jared Weaver has said on Twitter, if you believe him, that he said his team never stole signs. And he responded to an allegation by Will Middlebrooks, former Red Sox prospect, that everybody was stealing signs. And we were just like, well, the Angels never did. And so there's a question about if that's true, is this really, does that change things from the steroid era where it was so commonplace that everybody knew? And the answer is probably yes, because there's no way that taking a bunch of HGH or shooting yourself up with steroids is going to make you a better pure hitter. It's not going to make you a better pure pitcher. Sure, you might be less prone to injury. You might hit the ball farther when you connect, but it's not going to improve your hand-eye coordination. It might, as a pitcher, add a couple of ticks to your fastball. And yes, that's not fair, but it's not going to make your curveball better than it was before. Whereas now, this is basically teams saying, okay, we know what's coming.
Yeah.
And that's a very, very different thing. That's a very different thing. So I'm not sure that we have enough information yet to know how this is going to be remembered. But I do think that given the we're talking about whether or not world championships should have been vacated, that's something we never talked about during the steroid era. So I think this is a different thing. And I am concerned because it does go to the integrity of the game at the end of the day. If you know what pitch is coming, that fundamentally changes the nature of how the game is played. And yes, stealing signs is as old as baseball, but there's a technological aspect here that's very disconcerting. And I talked about this with Julie DeCaro on her radio show here in Chicago. What is the, so the Astros had this camera out in center field, a high-speed electronic camera that they were pointing in to see the catcher's signs. They could have taken that camera and they could have pointed it at the pitcher's mound and read the lips of the pitcher when he's talking to the catcher, or read the lips of everybody when they're having meetings on the mound. What's the difference? Or if they take a microphone and mic up the pitcher's mound so they can hear what everybody's saying, what's the difference? There really isn't one. And that kind of shows how different this is. Because I think if you look at it that way, it's the technological equivalent of miking up the pitcher's mound and listening to their conversation, or taking that camera and sticking it in zooming in on the mound and seeing what everybody's saying during meetings. If we were talking about a situation where they were doing that overtly during, I mean, the Patriots got in trouble in the NFL for less. Mm-hmm. So we do need to take this with the seriousness that it deserves. I think this is worse than the steroid era by an order of magnitude. And I don't think we know exactly how bad it's going to be yet.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that I think the phrase I use, so I wrote about this recently the article dropped today, for the Hardball Times. And it was more about like the cynicism this all breeds amongst fans and how you reckon with this as a fan and kind of like kill your heroes and all of that stuff. It was more that angle. But like I think the line I used in that article was, is the chess match between pitcher and hitter the most essential part of baseball no longer sacred? And that, I think, gets at the essence of what the issue with this sign stealing scandal is that the pitcher-hitter chess match is, like, what makes baseball baseball to me. And that sort of, the fact that this scandal sort of sullies that is what makes me so deeply uncomfortable with it as from the integrity of the game perspective.
The other thing, and I think this, kind of going to your point, if you look at the number, the triple slash batting lines for every Astros star, every single one of them between 2016 and 2017, there's a sizable jump. Every single one of them. And when I wrote about it for Hardball Times, I put down those triple slash lines. Altuve had the smallest jump because he was coming from the highest baseline, but Correa took a jump. George Springer took a jump. Alex Bregman took a big jump, every single one of them, all of the big stars. And that raises an uncomfortable question of how good are they really? And it's not to say that these aren't good players. They are. And you cannot realistically argue the Astros are a bad team, because if the Orioles had done the same thing, they would still have lost 100 games. The bigger question is, how good are they really? And how much of the disparity between the haves and the have-nots is due to this kind of thing? Because if you think about it, it doesn't make sense for the Royals to go out and steal a bunch of signs. They're not going anywhere anyway. So is the disparity in talent that we see between the top-tier teams and the bottom-tier teams as big as we think it is, or just because the high-end teams are just stealing a bunch of signs to prepare for stealing a bunch of signs in the playoffs, and they're looking for every edge to win as many games as possible? And I wonder if there is now a legitimate question about how big that disparity really is. Is a jump that a player gets going from a bad team to a good team because they're joining a good team, because they're really getting better, or because there's some kind of other advantage that they're getting? And these are questions that we don't really know the answers to, and I don't think we will until we have a pretty big sample size into the 2020 season, and we can see, okay, how are teams like the Astros and the Red Sox doing now that ostensibly this kind of thing isn't happening anymore?
And this is sort of the natural, like, end point of the fetishizing of, you know, efficiency and stuff, right? Which ties back into
the McKinsey approach.
Yes, yes, it's the McKinsey approach to baseball, and we're surprised when this is what happens.
But this was predictable. Like, we talked before about dehumanizing baseball players, turning them into assets. They acquired Roberto Osuna because they viewed him as, like, a buy low stock. That's how they viewed him. It is completely unsurprising that an organization with that kind of attitude is going to say, screw the rules. We're doing this anyway, because they absolutely knew what they were doing. They absolutely knew what they were doing. The question at the end of the day is, how interested is Manfred in stopping this? And this is one other question that I don't know the answer to, that not many people have raised, but I think is important. The sign stealing came out because it was connected to Brandon Taubman, because Brandon Taubman was a word I should not say on your podcast.
We say all the bad words here.
If he hadn't, would we have ever known? If he had not been a misogynistic prick to Allison Footer, would any of this have ever come out? And the answer is, I don't know, because it's possible it wouldn't have, because all of this started with Brandon Taubman, and thank effing God we got Osuna to Allison Footer because he was being a misogynist on purpose. And there is a part of me that wonders how much the Astros were disciplined for that as opposed to the sign stealing, because it happened during the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
Because if there's one thing Manfred is protective of, it is the World Series. And he went out of his way to discipline Taubman in this order that was ostensibly about the sign stealing scandal. So I keep coming back to this idea that the biggest issue with the Astros was that they got caught.
Yep.
And it's hard for me to shake that feeling, because I cannot sit here and say, yeah, if not for Taubman, this would have all come out anyway, because I don't think it would have. And at the end of the day, that's a scary thought also.
Yep.
And what else isn't coming out?
Yeah.
Yeah. What do we not know about?
For me also, like, there was the whole thing with, like, Beltran's niece and everything just kind of came to a head, like, whether it was her or not or whatever. Like, then, like, wild accusations just started flying, like, Mike Trout uses HGH, and everybody started being, like, their own detective. And for
me, it was the internet equivalent of that escalated quickly.
Yeah, exactly. And for me, that just shows, like there's so much cynicism. Like, everybody was willing to believe this because nobody trusts anything that's coming out of, like, you know, the institution of baseball. Everybody, like, the trust is completely gone. The cynicism is, you know, on the rise, and it's just sad that this is what it's gotten to be, that you'd rather believe a Twitter rando that has no claim to Carlos Beltran. Like, no, how do you know that's really who that is? But everybody was so willing to believe that Twitter account, and just because she made an accusation that I don't know that people were willing to believe or wanted to believe, just to see the Astros fall further. I don't know, but it was a sad day.
It was, especially because Mike Trout, I mean, even in the worst possible framing of Mike Trout, so he would ostensibly have a medical condition where a doctor is prescribing him illegal medication for his medical condition. If that was true, and evidently it's not, But even if that was true, the scandal would be how careless Major League Baseball is being with player health data, mm-hmm. not that yes. he was using a bad substance. So, and I feel like that's something that should be pointed out, that Mike Trout isn't innocent in all of this, at least as far as this is concerned. But it comes back to the who is standing to benefit from this. If I put all 30 Major League majority owners in a room and said, here are 30 billionaires, will you trust what they're saying? Would you have any reason to?
Absolutely not.
And these are the people who hired Rob Manfred.
Wait, in this scenario, am I also a billionaire? Because then I would probably trust them. Billionaires love billionaires.
But and I get that, but like, there's a reason, especially after the last few years, why we as a society are skeptical of billionaires. And I think that is warranted, because there's been some math on this that shows that it's pretty difficult to accrue $1 billion without being kind of dickish along the way. It's really kind of hard to do. So if you're saying, okay, these are the 30 people who hired Rob Manfred, these are the 30 people who own baseball, now believe them. We wouldn't believe them if they ran for public office. We wouldn't believe them if they were sponsoring a public works project. And for good reason, why would we believe them with respect to baseball? And so as much as the cynicism makes me sad, I do think it's good in that we should be aware of just who it is, who is really running the game that we love so much. And is that a good thing? And should we demand more? There is a reason why the Green Bay Packers have, for the most part, been relatively scandal-free. And that ownership model does seem to have more buy-in from fans. It isn't perfect. They have made a lot of mistakes. But I think that there is something to that ownership model that makes sense as compared to the extremely rich people hire other extremely rich person to further their interests under the guise of managing the sport, which is what we have now.
Folks, this is certainly now the nationalized baseball podcast.
Yes.
Sorry if this isn't what you came for, but if you've been listening to the podcast, you shouldn't be surprised. So.
Well, and there's also something to be said for, you know, and I think it's something that people joke about a lot for obvious reasons, the idea of like, fans running the teams, but fans want their teams to win, and more often, and maybe it's not really more and more often, but it's more obvious now than ever before that a lot of owners don't, or at least that, you know, they want to win insofar as it is the easiest path to higher profits. But that the winning itself is secondary, and the sport is at its best when people want to win. Now, that can go too far. There are steroids and wires and video cameras and all kinds of things.
And trash cans.
Oh, trash cans. But we want them to want to win. It gets really messy and sad when they don't. Derek Jeter and his $1.99 Marlins are a testament to that. And I'll tell if fans own the team, they're going to win.
You know, there's something about the payroll versus winning thing that always gets me. Were the Astros trying to win? I mean, the basic idea is, yeah, sure, they're stealing signs because they want to win. But just keep in mind the same team that let Derek Cole walk. The win-at-any-cost mentality is, yes, that partly explains the Astros, but not all the way. The Astros weren't running a Dodger-style payroll, even at its highest. Yeah, they ran up a big payroll, but it wasn't, compared to the rest of the league, the way the Yankees were back in the mid-aughts when the Yankees were far and away the biggest payroll in the game. It's win at any cost breaking the rules while still not spending too much money. That's really what they were doing. it's basically a how many people can we exploit to win model, as opposed to a we will do anything it takes to win model, where they viewed the path of least resistance not as getting as many good players as possible, but by giving the players they had as many unfair advantages as possible.
Well, do you think
No, go ahead.
I was just wondering if this would kind of turn people off to tanking, because how do you know it worked? Because they kind of circumvented tanking. Like, they clearly tanked, but then they kind of, like, enhanced their tanking afterwards.
Enhanced tanking.
You know, the tanking brand has taken a real hit.
The Astros old owner, Drayton McLean, he sued Jim Crane a while back, saying that the tanking was a scam. Nobody took him seriously. Nobody took him seriously. I didn't take him seriously because I thought it was a stupid lawsuit. And all of a sudden, we're looking at this and we're saying, well, now it doesn't look so stupid anymore. And I have no idea if this is what he actually had in mind, but all of a sudden his lawsuit looks a good deal better than it did before. But I think it should turn teams off to tanking. Not necessarily because this is the necessary outcome of how tanking works, but also because I don't think that if you look at, okay, how does tanking work in terms of rebuilds? Well, it depends on how you define what your window is going to be. The Cubs were told, we're going to tear it down and tank, and then we'll contend every year. And as soon as they won one World Series, all of a sudden austerity kicks in. So I think when fans are being told, yeah, we have to pare down payroll and sell everything that isn't tied down, and then we'll win all of these World Series in a row, they have to realize that's not what's going to happen. It's really not. Because what's really going to happen is what's happening with the Cubs right now. If you're lucky, maybe you win one championship, and then all of a sudden you start getting trade rumors about every star you have. The Astros, who are considered the success story of tanking, they just let arguably the best pitcher in baseball, not named Jacob DeGrom, walk in free agency because they supposedly didn't have the money. So it's really kind of amazing how tanking is sold. And one thing I loved last year was the Minnesota Twins, who won 100 games because they spent some money on good players, even after everybody was like, oh, well, you should tank because you're not good enough. And they won the division. They won 100 games. And yes, the division was historically awful, but they still did win 100 games. And then they went out and they got more players, because they were actually trying to get better. Same thing with Cincinnati. And I think you are seeing teams start to move away from the tear everything down and have a fire sale model to the we should actually get good players model. But there are still some teams that are clinging to the old model. But I've never thought the tanking was actually about getting better. I've always thought it was about saving money. And I think the Marlins are no exception. Because the Marlins deal never made sense from a financial perspective unless it was an investment deal. That's the only way it ever made sense.
That's why it'd help us if Fred Wilpon ever learns about tanking.
Yeah, that's the one advantage of the Mets being not just 5 years behind, but like 15 years behind, is that by the time they learn about tanking, it might be over. And so...
the problem is, Steve Cohen, I guarantee you, already knows.
Yeah, that's true.
He's Steve Cohen.
Yeah.
He is pre-tanked.
He already knows. the funny thing is, Steve Cohen would probably be in prison if Trump had not been elected. And I mean that because one of Cohen's attorneys ended up on Trump's transition team.
Oh, jeez. Good stuff.
Also yucky.
Oh, yes. Yes. So it is. And that I wrote about that for Beyond the Box Score. There is Preet Bharara, who... he was the prosecutor for the Southern District of New York. He was going after Cohen for years. And there was actually an entire book written about it that I highly recommend. You can read it. I forget the name of it because it's too late and I worked all day and I'm sorry. But it's an excellent book, and it goes through how Steve Cohen basically invented the modern form of insider trading and how he ran the scam from beginning to end and how he just barely managed to escape without prison time even after his company got a $1.8 billion fine. That's a billion with a B, levied for the insider trading. And basically what he was doing, and tell me if this sounds familiar to a baseball team we were just talking about, he would tell his traders to go and get information about how companies were going to perform in the future, but he didn't want to know how they got it. Because his idea was, if you don't tell me, I won't go to prison. So his entire business model was premised on the acquisition of information that wasn't supposed to be public knowledge, and then trading based on that information that wasn't supposed to be public knowledge. And his idea was, it's not insider trading because they never told me what the information was.
Your new Mets owner, everyone. Get excited.
Yay.
Yay.
Gonna save the Mets. No more good guys. But nationalized baseball, then we won't have these billionaire owners.
Yep.
Part of the problem. So we are going to take one more break, and after these messages, we are going to finish off the show with walk-off wins like we do every week. So stay tuned.
Because we need it.
Yes. Okay. We are back. So we are going to finish off the show like we always do with walk-off wins, where each of us talks about what is making us happy this week, baseball-related or otherwise. Cheryl Ring, what is your walk-off win?
Larry Walker getting into the Hall of Fame. Larry Walker, who, by the way, is the... And I'm going to enrage a lot of people with this, but Larry Walker, who was the best player inducted to the Hall of Fame this year,
Woo! And
well-deserving.
Love it, Cheryl, with the spicy takes. A+.
Amen. That is a very popular take on a Mets podcast.
Yes, it is. No arguments here.
Linda Servich, what is your walk-off win?
He was a better player.
He was.
Yes, that's true.
My walk-off went, well, we talked about this briefly with Kate last podcast, but I went to go see Knives Out, and it was very good. Daniel Craig absolutely steals the show. Just give it all the awards, hands down. I don't know if it's up for awards. I think it is. Just give them all of them. Because
it's not nominated for Best Picture.
Oh, boo.
It is not, yeah.
Well, it should still win anyway. It was original. Like, sometimes I feel like Hollywood is out of ideas, but, like, this was fresh, and it was fun, and it kept you guessing, and James Bond and Captain America being in it doesn't hurt. But the cast was amazing, and it was just, it was different. It was a fun, like, mystery that, like, relied on, like, you know, keeping you guessing. And so I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it not being nominated for Best Picture is a travesty, now that I've just learned this bit of information.
Sorry to be the bearer of bad news during the happy segment.
I know, but still, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I think everybody else should go see it. So that's my walk-off win.
Good. Maggie Wiggin, what is your walk-off win for this week?
My walk-off win is the Children's Museum of Manhattan, because Monday came around after a full weekend, a full cold, yucky weekend, and my darling children were, I really, really wanted to start missing them again. and I was just like, we go to the Transit Museum a lot, but the Transit Museum's closed on Mondays, because why should I have anything that makes us happy? But I sort of remembered this Upper West Side Children's Museum, and so we went, and immediately I was like, oh God, what have we done? Because there was a 15-minute wait outside in the 20-degree weather to get inside. And, like, I guess because we just didn't have any better ideas, and the kids were already super gung-ho about it, we decided to, like, wait it out. Get in there. And it was wonderful. The kids both, like, you know, I have a 5-year-old son who has, like, some sensory needs and other things. And then a daughter who's an absolute, like, she's 2 years old and she's a monster. And that mean that in the best way possible. And they both had just so much fun. They, there was climbing space and like build your own roller coasters and books and dance, like videos where you can like mimic all these dances from around the world. It's a really beautiful museum. It's the Children's Museum of Manhattan. It's on the Upper West Side. There are 8,000 children's museums in this city. So if you're searching for it, you have to be kind of specific. But it was great. And I'm really excited to go back. And yeah, so that's my walk-off win. Yay, Children's Museum of Manhattan.
That's great. Yeah, that sounds really fun. I mean, like, I still really like exhibits like that as a complete nerd. And, like, I go to things that are, like, made for children. And I still really enjoy them. Like, all of the things that, you know, the Franklin Institute, for example, really enjoy the life-size heart, all of that stuff. So my walk-off win is just a really pleasant weekend that I had in New Paltz visiting Michael. We did kind of like a mini Mid-Hudson brewery tour and went to a few different breweries in the general vicinity. We also saw a movie. We saw 1917, which is nominated for Best Picture. I know, I'm sorry. I
can't believe you would rub it in Linda's face like that.
Seriously, rude. That's rude.
If you bang an Oscar on a trash can, will it change anything?
There's only one way to find out.
It works for the Oscars.
Yeah, well, we get like a last minute envelope change like we did the time that Moonlight won the Oscar.
Oh.
Just bang a trash can and change the Best Picture. But yeah, I mean, I think Michael enjoyed the movie more than I did, but I still liked it a lot. I think it deserves all of the like cinematography things it's probably nominated for. Like, it was just a beautifully shot film. Like, just gorgeously shot. And it's, like, for those of you who don't know about, like, the 1917's, like, shtick, it's that, like, cinematography-wise, it's that, you watch it, and it's like it's one long take. Obviously, it wasn't one long take, but that's how it looks to you when you're watching it. So I thought that was really cool, and it made for, like, a unique movie experience that you don't usually get. So that was, like, an unexpected part of it that I really liked. So, yeah, we saw a movie, the movie theater's in the mall, so we did a little necessary shopping. We both got Christmas gift cards from various family members, and we were like, time to use these now. So that was nice. Both got things we needed. Yeah, the brewery tour was the best part. And my favorite part of the brewery tour was at one of the breweries, Hudson Ale Works. There was a periodic table of beer types. And I was like, this appeals very uniquely to my sensibilities as a scientist and beer enthusiast. So I appreciated that a lot. And I love when I go on brewery tours, I love when I encounter people that work there that are clearly like science nerds, because there are a lot of them in the brewing business, because brewing is chemistry.
This is very true. So, can confirm.
Yeah. So it's just really fun. And I really enjoyed the beers I had, and it was just a nice, pleasant 3-day weekend, because obviously yesterday was Martin Luther King Day. I am a government employee, so I get off all of the state holidays. So it was just a very pleasant weekend that I had, and that is my walk-off win. So everyone, please go to amazingavenue.com. We have your Beltran stuff covered in addition to everything else. Our top 25 prospect lists are out. We'll soon be ramping up, you know, spring training coverage once that comes around. But in the meantime, you can read all of our news and analysis posts. You can follow the show on Twitter at A Pod of Their Own. You can follow Amazing Avenue, the site, on Twitter at Amazing Avenue, the same on Instagram and Facebook. You can follow each of us on Twitter. I am at Petite PhD. Where are you, Linda?
At Linda Servage.
And you, Maggie?
At Maggie162.
Show a ring. Where can our listeners find you on the internet?
I am at @ring_Cheryl. Ring like the jewelry, Cheryl with an S, not a C.
And you can find her work at Beyond the Box Score. And yeah, thank you so much, Cheryl, for your time and coming on today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a blast.
Everyone, original music for this podcast is by Bunga. Let's go Mets. And don't forget, there is no crying in podcasting.